Well, most of us, I guess, know or think we know something about the annual National Prayer Breakfast held in Washington, D.C., where American pollies, both Democrats and Republicans, and other invited guests get together for prayer and Weet-Bix. The president is always the last to speak at these breakfasts. But what we don't know is what I didn't know until I read Jeff Charlotte's book, is that the breakfasts are only, or one of the only publicised events of this group, the family, otherwise known as the Fellowship. Some would argue that it's not exactly a secret religious cult, but its members do believe that the more invisible they are, the more influential they will become. So I think Jeff's done everyone a favour by shining a bright light upon them. He joins me on the phone from New York to talk about the family. And Jeff is a contributing editor for Harper's, that splendid journal, and Rolling Stone, and associate research scholar at New York University's Center for Religion and Media. Jeff also edits therevealer.org and is the author of the book I hold in my hand, The Family, Power, Politics and Fundamentalism's Shadow Elite. And I must say the cover is brilliant. It looks like a very worn, battered old family Bible with the brown leather coming through the black paint. Jeff, welcome to our little wireless program.
Hello, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get on to how you got involved and why you wrote the book, I think it's important just to set this up by telling us what the theology of the family is. Now, where does it vary from standard issue Christianity?
Yeah, it really does. It goes, you know, the family is a 70-year-old organization. It began with what the founder of the group, a man named Abraham Verady, thought was a new revelation he'd been given from God one night in April of 1935 in the midst of America's Great Depression. He thought that God had come to him and told him that Christianity had been getting it wrong, essentially, for 2,000 years by focusing on the poor, the suffering, the weak, the down and out. And he believed he had a vision that told him to focus literally on those whom he would come to call the up and out. And by that, he meant those who were wealthy, the elite. And he thought that God now cared about the most powerful. And if you can help the most powerful, well, then out of the goodness of their hearts, they'll help the rest of us. And so it becomes a sort of trickle-down theology, this trickle-down religion.
And, of course, currently it seems to fit the zeitgeist perfectly. Okay, now you spent a month at a place called Ivanwalde, a house you describe as devoted to the service of a personal Jesus. One must be recommended to this place. I haven't been invited. Who recommended you?
At the time I was working on my first book, a book called Killing the Buddha, which obviously comes from a Buddhist saying about unusual religious communities around the United States. And I've been writing about religion for many years. And a friend of mine got in touch with me because she was concerned that her brother had joined a cult. He had left a good career in finance and left his fiancée to go and move into this house, Ivanwalde. And so I agreed to meet with him and talk to him about what he had gotten involved in. And what was interesting was he almost immediately sort of started recruiting me and inviting me and telling me I had to come down and see this for myself. And so there was a sense in which I was never undercover because I was invited by someone who had known me for years. And I think he was so confident that I would see this as divine work that I would immediately be caught up into it. But
answer this honestly. Was there a moment, a nanosecond, when you wavered?
About whether or not to go?
No, about the sales pitch, when you were there.
That's a very good question. You're the first person to ask that question. That's a great question. No, there was never a point in which, you know, within days, I realized that there was a steady drumbeat of very authoritarian rhetoric invoking terrible names, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, this idea that these strong men somehow exemplified the teachings of Jesus perfectly. Now, they would say Hitler, Stalin, and Mao are evil.
I'm sorry. But they would... I've just had to turn the microphone off and bellow with laughter. You
yeah.
have to be kidding.
Yeah, so I was never tempted. I was never tempted by that. But that's a good question because, you know, what was interesting about it is that in the context of that fundamentalist world, it was almost utopian. And so it was a house at the end of a cul-de-sac, and there's about 20 houses all owned by family members, and at the end of the road was a great big mansion. And it was a very idyllic experience. So day to day, you could almost sort of forget yourself and just say, this is so peaceful, and here we are, we're the new chosen, God's new chosen people, and you could go along with it. And then someone would come along and say, let's talk about the leadership lessons of Hitler, and you'd remember where you were.
And, and people who I thought were dead for centuries, like Ed Meese, would appear amongst you.
Yeah, I was as surprised by that myself. Ed Meese, Ronald Reagan's former attorney general, ended up being drummed out, in part, actually, ironically, in response to a perceived ethics lapse related to intervention on behalf of Saddam Hussein. There was an Iraqi pipeline deal. He had all kinds of troubles. He was a very troublesome figure. And he shows up one morning. It turns out he hosts a weekly breakfast there for foreign diplomats and American businessmen and American politicians. And so I was invited to come and attend and as sort of one of the younger visitors there 1 week. And, you know, what I since learned is that then I went and researched Ed Meese is that, in fact, you know, these guys don't disappear when they go out of politics. Many of them, in fact, become more powerful. Meese is certainly more powerful now, I think, than he ever was as a beleaguered attorney general. He's a broker between social and business conservatives in America.
Right, right. I told the listener before you came on the program that the only president that seems to have been a fully-fledged member was Gerald Ford, who took the family's advice on whether or not to pardon Nixon.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and that's, you know, to do this book, I went and I lived with him for a month, and then I spent years going around to archives around the country. They had dumped 600 boxes of papers at Billy Graham's archives, and I spent a long, long time in that. But that little fact, Gerald Ford's membership and the role of his membership in his pardon for Nixon astounded me because it was reported in the New York Times. But here's the catch. It was reported in the religion pages, and no one paid attention. There was an article that said, plain as day, Gerald Ford has convened his old fellowship prayer cell, this group called the Fellowship, and he's going to be praying with a man named Melvin Laird, who was Nixon's Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, and a couple conservative congressmen, and they ask God what God wants them to do with Nixon. And surprise, four conservatives all decreed that Nixon should get a pass.
Now, you've made the point that you didn't go there under false pretenses, but did they realize that apart from being a writer, that you were half Jewish? And if so, what was their reaction to this?
Not only did they realize, I think that's a big part of why I got in. They're really only interested in recruiting elites, you know, to go back to the idea, as Abraham Baraity, the founder, called it, this idea of reaching out to the up and out, to key men, to those who have influence. So most of the young men at Ivanwald were from wealthy families. Some of them were sent there by the governments. There was a man from Norway sent by his government. There was two lawyers sent by the president of Benin. And what did I have to recommend me? Well, one, actually, the fact that I was a journalist, which is to say, you know, from their perspective, an influencer. And two, that I'm half Jewish. And I think one of the oddities of the family is they believe that Jesus Christ transcends all religions. So they don't ask you to convert if you're another religion. They just say, well, just bow before Jesus. All Jesus requires is your obedience. So you can be a Jewish follower of Jesus, or you can be, well, they referred to Suharto, the late dictator of Indonesia, as a Muslim follower of Jesus.
That revelation, and I use the word revelation quite deliberately, is going to resonate across Australia because, of course, we had a very close and somewhat troubled relationship with Suharto.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. And, you know, as as did the United States, unfortunately, from my perspective. You know, and one of the things that really startled me in going through their archives and then confirming this in presidential archives around the country was to see the role that religion had played in fostering U.S. support for Indonesia. Now, you know, that's not to say at the height of the Cold War that the United States wasn't going to get involved with Suharto either way, but the family was really there, right there at the beginning of that relationship, right there in the U.S. Embassy. And very quickly, once Suharto got into power, the family began organizing delegations of congressmen and oil executives.
Yeah. Well, we're familiar, of course, with the relationship of American evangelical energies in Israel, but the thought that it extends to Jakarta comes as a complete shock to me. Tell us a bit about C Street House.
The C Street House is sort of like an Ivanwald for congressmen. It's on C Street, which is right there on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. It's actually a former convent. It's a very beautiful townhouse that the family bought and turned into a home for, at any given time, 6 to 8 congressmen will live there, and they'll be in sort of full-time spiritual counseling with the leader of the family, a man named Doug Coe. And they're paying below market rent, which makes this ethically a questionable endeavor. The building is registered at the church, so the family, meanwhile, is not paying any taxes, although they're keeping it quite quiet that it's a church. Another oddities of the family is that they don't really like church. Church is okay for the masses, but the elites don't need church. The elites are supposed to find the relationship.
Well, perhaps they'd be happy just in the spire, sitting up in the pointy bit with their sort of elite views. Really, really interesting. And at this C Street place, there were lots and lots of young senators.
Yeah. I mean, during my time, I met Senator John Ensign, who's a fairly powerful Republican from Nevada. Senator Sam Brownback, who is one of the leading conservative senators from Kansas, and in fact, John McCain has just announced that if elected president, Senator Brownback will have a sort of a veto power on any of his judicial appointments.
Oh my God!
Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, who is a senator that everyone around the world should be concerned with, because he is the leading opponent of any legislation to address global warming. In the U.S. He doesn't believe global warming exists. And he says, even if it did, you know, we have to leave it in God's hands. We have to free the market, no regulation, let go and let God in the evangelical parlance.
I'm talking to Jeff Charlotte on what has become a horror program. This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod while there is still time. That is, of course, before the family takes over the entire planet. Tell us a bit more about the current leader, Doug Coe, because he sounds like a darling.
Yeah, he is that. A remarkably charismatic man, actually. One of the most charismatic people I've met in writing about religion over the years. I've come across a few. A man in his late 70s from Oregon came to Washington in 1959 after a fairly ordinary career as an evangelist, but I think was tapped for his ability to sort of move effortlessly among the powerful. And one of the very first sort of conquests that he made was a dictator named Papadoc Duvalier of Haiti.
Yes, we remember him fondly. The world is the poorer for his absence.
Yes. The great electrifier of souls, he called himself. He believed he actually was God. An odd man for Coe to decree as a man of God and arrange for U.S. support for. And Coe was this interesting character because I think in the late 60s, he was the man who really perceived that, look, this thing's going to be more effective if we can take it underground. That was his word. In the late 60s, he sent out a memo to all the leadership saying, let's submerge. More recently, he's been connected with Hillary Clinton, who calls him in her memoir a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and God and guide. This is a man.
There's another reason to vote for Obama.
Indeed. And this is a man who regularly invokes Hitler. The only trinity he really talks about is Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And, you know, the irony of this.
They're sort of like a holy trinity, are they?
Yeah. Sorry?
They're sort of like a holy trinity, those three.
They are. There's actually audio sermon you can find online in which he says, He talks about Mao training the Red Guard to chop off the heads of their parents, and he says, and they could do that. That's right out of the New Testament. He says they understood the total commitment, the total obedience, and the total authority that Jesus was teaching. He's a very scary character.
Jeff, this is so extraordinary. And I'm sad to say, listener, that Al Gore is also loosely affiliated. Jeff, tell us that story.
I'm sorry, you just have to repeat that last bit?
No, I want you to tell the listener about Al Gore.
Oh, Al Gore. Well, you know, I mean, the thing about American politics is that, as some religion observers in Washington say, that Doug Coe kind of holds, ironically, the kosher stamp of approval for religion in Washington. You can't do religion in Washington without Doug Coe. Time magazine called him the stealth persuader and noted that he'd been an advisor to every president since Nixon. So Al Gore, of course, had a relationship to him. And, you know, it's important to remember that Al Gore, early in his Senate career, was extremely conservative. He was pro-life, pro-gun, pro-war. He was a very conservative politician. And, he's had an evolution, as it were, over the years. To a more progressive spot. But, you know, you really saw Gore's connection, and this was an interesting moment, fairly unremarked upon in the American media, unfortunately, when Gore was called to testify before the Senate just a year or two ago about global warming. Inhofe, Senator Inhofe, who I mentioned, the opponent of global warming legislation, was really lighting into him, really grilling him. And Gore defended himself by saying, you know what, Senator Inhofe, he says, let's talk about this at a private breakfast with our mutual friend, Doug Coe.
And that was code. That was code. Yeah.
Yeah, that should have set off every alarm of investigative reporting in America, and unfortunately it didn't.
You see, it's interesting, isn't it? Outsiders, people looking into American politics like myself, and to its religious connections, we know that Jesse Helms, we also know that that the official presidential pastor for many years seemed to be Billy Graham, forever kneeling in the Oval Office with Nixon on one side and Henry Kissinger on the other. Yeah. But all the time, he was nothing like as important as this group.
Oh, Billy Graham is pretty important. It's funny, Doug Coe's friend in Washington, Senator Sam Brown back, in fact, for instance, is explaining to Doug Coe to me, says, well, he's sort of a shadow Billy Graham. And, you know, to which you want to ask, well, why do you need a shadow Billy Graham? Why do you need a secret Billy Graham? And, you know, Doug Coe, I think you referenced this at the beginning, but Doug Coe is very emphatic that there's something to be gotten from secrecy. You know, let me read you something that he says in one of his sermons. He says, the family functions invisibly like the mafia. The mafia keeps their organization invisible. Everything visible is transitory. Everything invisible is permanent and lasts forever. The more you can make your organization invisible, the more influence it will have. And you could argue that, indeed, you know, Billy Graham has that sort of that public touch of approval, but I think Doug Coe had probably greater access to a greater range of politicians than any preacher in American history.
Yes, Graham is on the record, unfortunately, as being anti-Semitic, but is there much anti-Semitism in the family?
Rarely expressed overtly. I think one of the family has its roots back in the 1930s, and back in those days, one could express fascist sympathies pretty openly. That's of course not the case anymore. And you know, one of the insights they had that separates them from the popular American Christian right, the ones we see on television. It's almost the law of kindergarten. If you don't have anything nice to say about anyone, don't say anything at all. And they don't. And they recognize that they don't need to badmouth people. They want access to power. That said, this group is structurally anti-Semitic in the sense that they believe that the Jews broke their covenant with God, and so they are no longer the chosen people. And the family believes that they themselves are the new chosen, as they call themselves. Yeah. And that new chosen has, in the past, after the war, included a lot of former Nazis who they were eager to recruit, men who became very powerful in the West German government, such as Hermann Hobbes, who was the longtime leader of the Deutsche Bank.
Of course, the pro-fascist attitudes have on the other side of the same coin an impassioned anti-communist dimension, don't they?
Indeed, indeed, yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's how a lot of the pre-war fascist sympathizers in America were able to sort of remake themselves. In particular, there was one man who, on the sort of, it was one of the leaders of the early family, a man named Merwin Hart, who had been a fairly influential, openly pro-Hitler fascist organizer among sort of wealthy businessmen before the war, had become, you know, absolutely toxic during the war, denounced by the U.S. Attorney General, denounced by FDR himself. And then you find him, here he is in the late 40s and the early 50s, and you find these congressmen saying, you know, Hart may be right, because Hart was then talking about anti-communism.
Sure.
And so that all that kind of fascist sympathy of the pre-war period funneled into and informed the virulence of the anti-communism that became a real suppression of any kind of political culture of dissent in America.
Your book is follows the anti-union thread right from the middle 30s. That's the idea, or the necessity to triumph over militant labor was up front, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there's a real Australian connection there, because the founder of the group, Abraham Verrady, had sort of identified this demonic figure in his mind, Satan incarnate, the red menace in a person, and it was an Australian immigrant to the United States, Harry Bridges.
Yeah, we know a bit about Harry. He was an extraordinary fella. So they went head to head, did they?
Well, Harry Bridges, of course, organized the great, really incredible strike in the United States in 1934, one of the biggest and most successful strikes in American history. And it was centered in San Francisco, where Abram Verrady was at the time giving spiritual counseling to the head of Standard Oil of California. And he was terrified by this, absolutely terrified. And it was in reaction to that that he then actually moved to Seattle, created a group of 19 businessmen and said, God will choose one among us to be governor. And indeed, they did. Apparently, he did. Arthur Langley, who became the longest-serving governor of the state of Washington. And on the strength of that political achievement, he was able to move across the country to the other Washington, Washington, D.C., and start organizing congressmen and saying, look, you know, labor, organized labor is communist. Organized labor is an affront to God. We need to have unregulated markets so that God, invisible hand, you know, the invisible hand of the market, they confuse that with God's hand, can be free to make rich those whom he chooses.
The author is Jeff Charlotte. The book is The Family, and the program is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Now, here's another connection with Australia. It's a looser one, but I find it intriguing. We've had a couple of major figures in the Labor Party, which is our version of the Democrats, one who very recently was within a hair's breadth of becoming our Prime Minister, who came from the moral rearmament tradition. His father, I'm talking about a fellow called Kim Beazley, and his father was inspired by Frank Buckman, who, of course, coined the term moral rearmament. Now, Buckman, as I understand it, also came up with the idea of cells, prayer cells, as your method of sort of getting people involved in elites of people involved in the political process, and that's a part of the family structure.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Buckman, the Moral Rearmament Group, or originally called the Oxford Group, and it is a politically, it's a slightly more ambiguous creature, because indeed some liberals did come out of it, or liberals, I guess, in the American sense of the term, but. And
well, certainly the fellow I'm talking about was on the progressive side.
Yeah, exactly.
Of politics.
Its roots were certainly not progressive. Buckman was another one of these guys who admired Hitler, and he said that what America needed is a God-controlled democracy, or perhaps I should say a theocracy. Or better yet, he said, a God-controlled fascist dictatorship. And that was Buckman talking about the kind of government that he dreamed of, and he thought that the best way to achieve that was by organizing elites into what you call cells, into these small groups. And Abram Verrady would later refine this idea, and he said, look, in a cell you can meet beyond the din of the vox populi, you know, the sort of pretentious little bit of Latin, beyond the sort of the noise and of the rabble, the voice of the people and so on, and that there you can make decisions led by God and, of course, the interests of the other elite men in your circle. And really, really anti-democratic movement. I mean, the later history of moral rearmament by which you somehow wind up with liberals coming out of it is another story, but it had a deeply conservative influence on American and German and British politics.
Is the only reason I raised it was because of this, you know, because I know of this connection. Okay, let's move on to this extraordinary National Prayer Breakfast, which has been held every year since when? Since the early 50s?
1953. You know, the interesting thing is if you ask most American congressmen, they'll tell you that it goes back to the founding of the Republic, which is exactly what the family wanted. They wanted to create a ritual civil religion that would appear to be, literally, Abraham Brady says, look, I want to dedicate the nation to God, to put us under the spiritual control of God. And he had been trying to do it for years. Truman, President Truman, refused. President Eisenhower at first did not want to do it. He recognized it as a violation of the separation of church and state, which is written into our Constitution. But a family member named Senator Frank Carlson, who was a sort of Eisenhower's right-hand man and had organized an evangelical vote for him, said, look, you owe it to us. So Eisenhower went, and it became this ritual. And to this day, if you're invited to the National Prayer Breakfast, and people all around the world are, about 4,000 people attend, foreign heads of state, there's always a delegation from Australia, your invitation comes on U.S. congressional letterhead. If you're a journalist and you want to go to the public part of it, you RSVP.
I'm sorry, my jaw just dropped. It goes out on official letterhead.
It goes out on official letterhead. Very few congressmen know that it's not a public event. It's entirely financed, organized, arranged by Doug Coe. No one speaks in the dais without Doug Coe's connection. And in fact, some years ago, there was actually a minor scandal in Taiwan when an intrepid reporter discovered that the Taiwanese government had been making substantial financial donations to one of the family's nonprofits, the Fellowship Foundation. And the government had a ready response. They said, of course we do this. You know, we make a donation to this organization. They put us a good table. We get FaceTime with the U.S. president. This is the best deal in foreign affairs you can find.
Well, the 2007 event, you tell us, drew, among others, a contingent of aid-hungry defense ministers from Eastern Europe, Pakistan's famously corrupt and now assassinated Benazir Bhutto, and a Sudanese general linked to genocide in Darfur. This is very ecumenical.
Yes, they're very open-minded, aren't they? You know, the funny thing is they say, look, you know, it's just open to anyone who feels led by the Spirit. And so often those from, especially from the sort of smaller countries that are sort of the satellites of the United States, those who are led by the Spirit tend to be the ministers of defense.
Well, Jeff, if in fact a lot of people who attended the thing are absolutely unaware of its background and its history and the string pulling, surely some of the competing religious organizations must get a bit miffed. Do any of them raise the alarm?
Not very often. I think, you know, the only people who are really going to be upset are the conservative organizations who are going to be upset because the event itself does not seem very conservative. In fact, they'll have non-Christians speak. One internal planning document I found says, look, anything can happen. Even the Quran could be read, but Jesus is there. He is infiltrating the world. And the conservative organizations know that. They know that despite the appearance of ecumenical you know, openness, that it's actually a fundamentalist outfit. And they know that because, you know, one of the tragedies of our American press here is they're not perhaps as curious as they could be. So there's a three-hour national prayer breakfast, but the event goes on for a week. The press is invited to the breakfast. They're not invited to the series of seminars that proceed. There's a seminar for defense executives. There's a seminar for oil executives, for banking executives, all to conform their industry.
Tell me they don't have one for media executives.
they actually have tried in the past. It was not terribly well attended. I suppose that's the one bit of good news. No, there's no conspiracy in American media's neglect of this subject. It's rather, here in the United States, a lot of our media is conditioned. When we think of fundamentalists, we think of men with Southern accents pounding the pulpit, banging their Bibles, and so on. We think of outsiders.
Yeah.
And the family are insiders. They're sophisticated, they're smooth, they're internationalists, they're in Washington. They don't look like what a fundamentalist is supposed to look like, and so the press just tends to ignore them.
Jeff, I have to ask you this about the breakfast itself. I take it there's no ham with the eggs. What do you actually have at the breakfast? Is it all those cornflakes straight out of Battle Creek and out of another religious tradition?
Oh, no, you get some very fresh melon. There are some delicious eggs. I mean, it's $425, so, they better be good eggs.
Okay, this is astonishing. Now, we've mentioned that Gerald Ford was a fully-fledged member, in much the same way as your incumbent president was a member of the Skull... What is it, the Skull and Bone Society?
Skull and Bones, which is kind of a harmless group.
Well, no, that's until you start investigating it, Jeff. Now, okay, where do we see evidence? Where do you see evidence that they are, in fact, powerful in terms of their influence? Give me a for instance.
One thing I write about in the book briefly is something called the Silk Road Act. This is a piece of legislation passed in 1999, renewed in 2006. And one of the things the family has always done, is focus on countries that the American public doesn't know much about. So, for instance, they knew that they could do a lot of business with Suharto because the American public didn't know what Indonesia was. The average American has never heard of Indonesia. I mean, it's a very provincial country, right? The Silk Road Act focuses on the Central Asian nations. And Senator Sam Brownback teamed up with Representative Joe Pitts of Pennsylvania, who's also a core member of the family, and he's in the House of Representatives. And together they were able to push through this bill, which pours money into some of these really nasty regimes in that part of the world, some of these dictatorships in Central Asia. And now, as Brownback explained to me, he said, look, this is we are interested in stopping the spread of radical Islam. This is a curious approach. If one thing we've learned is if you want to foster radical Islam, dictators are the best way to do it. Democracy is the best, I think, response to fundamentalism. But there's another side effect of the Silk Road Act, which is it was a part of a series of trade deals which proved tremendously beneficial to corporations like Koch Industries, one of the world's largest power suppliers involved in natural gas, and, as it happens, Senator Brownback's biggest financial backer. And, what looks like cronyism to us, to them, looks like God's mysterious ways. They just see that as confirmation that they're doing God's work. If they pass a piece of legislation that pours money into the coffers of the corporation, which then makes donations to their campaign.
Jeff, have you felt at risk during the process of writing and promoting this book? Are you being fingered? May you disappear at some time in the next couple of weeks?
I think I'm safe, but I first wrote about this and way back in 2003 in Harper's Magazine, and afterwards, family members would get in touch with me, and we had gone through the whole fact-checking process. We'd given them the right to respond and all this kind of thing. Family members would get in touch with me in the strangest ways, and one of the strangest was a young woman who wrote to me saying that she was a fan of my work and she wanted to meet with me and could we have a coffee date. And I'm thinking, my gosh, this is not standard response to journalism. This is something else. But of course, no one is that great a fan of my work, and indeed she turns out after an hour or two to confess that she has been sent by the family. They had had a meeting with a group of lawyers and so on, and she'd been sent, she said, to learn my heart. And it was such an odd, strange thing. I felt a little bit like Ralph Nader. I don't know if Australians are familiar with Ralph Nader, who
yes,
very famously
we know Ralph
on the car
well,
companies. Yeah. The car companies hired prostitutes to try and seduce him, to kind of smear his reputation. So that didn't work. The other interesting response is I had a speaking engagement in Berlin, part of the Einstein Forum there, and all the American speakers are normally paid for by the U.S. Embassy. I get off the plane. My German host greets me. He says, there's a problem. He says, your ambassador says he's not paying for you. And I'm startled. My ambassador knows who I am. This is, boy, I've really made it, huh? And he says, your ambassador says you are an enemy of Jesus. And I thought, this is incredible. The ambassador turned out to be a man named former Senator Dan Coats, a man so conservative that he was Bush's first choice for Secretary of Defense, and Cheney vetoed him as too right-wing.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, this guy. He's not too bright either. His mentor was
well. That wouldn't harm his prospects.
Yeah. If Cheney thinks you need to mail out, you're really in a frightening way.
And if you've been mentored by Dan Quayle, so how far up into the Bush administration has the family got? We're very well aware of the neocons and the theocons, but are there people specifically family connected that you can identify in? On Pennsylvania Avenue?
Sure. There's something, I don't know if this makes news in Australia, there's something called faith-based initiatives, which is one of Bush's big projects. The American media, in fact, doesn't pay enough attention to it. They don't recognize it. When you look at it, this is a fundamental and enduring transformation of American government. It's basically a big giveaway. It's a privatization. And faith-based initiatives was actually a project that began with Ed Meese in the 1980s. Senator Dan Coats, whom I just mentioned, and Senator John Ashcroft, as a senator in the late 90s, wrote the legislation that would then become Bush's program. And the program has been really family territory in the Bush administration. Senator John Ashcroft, who then became Attorney General Ashcroft, was also a longtime family member. In their archives, I found letters.
Ashcroft was a member of the family.
Oh, yes. Ashcroft, back in the 1980s, when he's just a nobody politician from Missouri, he writes Doug Coe, the leader. He says, look, I really want to bring Jesus. I want to get Jesus right into the heart of American government. And can you help me? And Doug Coe certainly can. What Doug Coe is really good at doing is making key introductions. David Kuo was former special assistant to President Bush, is quite open about this, about how Doug Coe basically made his career introducing him to the people in the Bush administration that resulted in him, in fact, being put in charge of faith-based initiatives for a while.
Now, you point out that Abram never achieved his dream of the United States becoming a theocracy, but it got close from time to time.
Well, you know, the real argument of the book, and I think this is important for Australians as well as Americans, is I think we tend to ask ourselves, what do the fundamentalists want? What will the world look like if they take it over, this kind of thing? The more relevant question, I think, is what have they already done? How have they shaped American democracy and pushed it toward becoming an American empire, which, of course, impacts everybody around the world? How have they shaped Australian government? There's a lot of investigation that can be done there. And when you look back at their history, you know, going back to their big defeats of organized labor in the late 40s, and then the relationships they built throughout the Cold War, and you see them always steering America rightward and toward this kind of expansionist, imperialist view, and that's the world that Abraham Brady dreamed. And so in some ways, sadly, that world has become true.
Jeff, there is some evidence amongst, say, the kids of the evangelicals that they're pulling back from this a little. That they are, in fact, saying, yes, we're worried about climate change. Yes, we might even cross-vote and go for Obama.
I think Obama will get about, if I was going to give a point spread on it, I think Obama will get 3% more of the evangelical vote than Democrats usually do, and that's significant. Actually, that can swing the election.
Not huge, but significant. Yeah,
that is significant. But you have to remember, you know, one of the other big arguments of the book is that we really need to understand fundamentalism as two movements. There's the populist movement. There's the kids. The kids are all right, and then there's the elites. There's the family, which are the insiders. They're never going to tie their fortunes too closely to one political party. They're always going to be bipartisan. They're not going to be doctrinaire in the way that, you know, the Bible thumpers, the pulpit pounders are.
Jeff, we've got to wind it up, but I've got to tell you, you've been one of the most fascinating guests in a long time. I congratulate you on the book, and please look over your shoulder. The Family,
thanks very much, Bill.
Power, Politics and Fundamentalism, Shadow Elite by Jeff Charlotte. It's published in Australia by the University of Queensland Press, and good on them for doing so. On our next, I'll be having my weekly chat with Bruce Shapiro in the US, and we'll look at exactly what the US and the European Union are up to with the Iranians. Oh, and I'll be talking to Walter Burley Griffin's grandnephew, who's gathered together a book of Griffin's writings on architecture, on planning cities, on landscape architecture, and, of course, on Canberra. Now, I'd be most grateful, as would ABC management. In fact, the board has asked me to pass this on to you. Stick around for the news on Radio National, and we'll see you later.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.